ॐ अज्ञानतिमिरान्धस्य ज्ञानाञ्जनशलाकाया चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरुवे नमः श्रीचैतन्यामनोभीष्टं स्थापितं येन भूतले स्वयं रूपा कदा मायां ददाति श्वापतन्तिकम् वन्देऽहं श्रीगुरौ श्रीयुतापदकमलं श्रीगुरून् वैष्णवंश्च श्रीरूपं साग्रजातां आगना रघुनाथान्वितं ठं सजीवं साद्वैतं सावधूतं हरिजनासहितं कृष्णचैतन्यदेवं श्रीराधा कृष्णपदान् आगना ललिता श्रीविशाखान्वितांश्च हे कृष्णा करुणा सिन्धु दीनाबन्धु जगत्पते गोपेशा गोपिकाकन्दा राधाकन्द नमोऽस्तु ते तप्ता कञ्चना गौरङ्गी राधे वृन्दावनेश्वरी वृषभानुसुते देवी प्रणमामि हरिप्रिये वंशकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभ्य एव च पतिथानां भावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः श्रीकृष्णा चैतन्या प्रवणतानन्द श्री अद्वैता गदाधर शिवाश्रि गौरभक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
Extremely grateful to be here today. I would like to thank all of you for so kindly taking your precious time to attend. IIT is one of the greatest educational institutions in India and in the world. Future leaders of our society in India and in the world are being created within the walls of this institution. To the degree we have influence over others, to that same degree we have very serious responsibility. Bhagavad Gita states, yad yad acharati sreshtas tad tad evitaro jana sayat pramanam kurute lokastharanupartate. What great and influential people do, the common people will follow that path. Yes? Can everyone hear? Is everyone able to hear? So with the great gift you're being given comes a great responsibility. And I appeal to all of you that you will have the influence to make a great difference in the world we live in. Today I was asked to speak on the subject of stress management. Many of you are students of engineering. In structural engineering or architectural engineering, a major problem that has to be resolved is stress, because the nature of this world is it's under the forces of gravity. Gravitational forces are pushing everything down, and when you construct a building, you're building it up, and gravity's pushing it down, so there's stress. Engineer knows that the beginning of solving the problem is a very strong foundation. Without a strong foundation, anything else you do in the building will not have longevity. When there is a stressful condition, it may be a storm, it may be rains, it may be age, time is very stressful, it deteriorates everything, then the building will collapse. So therefore, strong foundation is essential to uphold a building. And in the same way, individually and collectively, everyone in this world is under stress. Unless we have a very strong foundation in our lives, we will break in that stressful condition. Look at the world around us socially. How much stress and tension there is. People, due to desires of the heart, break and perform great immoral, unethical activities. This Enron scandal, I'm sure you're more familiar than myself. They were under stress. They were losing money. And they resorted to unethical, immoral activities. And what was the result? How they suffered, and how the entire society suffers, how the world is economically suffering. Because they couldn't uphold ethics and morality under stress. Individually, suicide is a great problem. Do you know in the United States of America, 1,000 people attempt to commit suicide every day, according to national statistics? This is supposed to be the most prosperous nation in the world. A nation that the whole world, in various ways, is trying to follow by creating happiness through material prosperity. But are they successful? Is this the model we want to follow? Let us examine carefully. Life is sacred. We shouldn't follow blindly. We should examine, we should question, we should evaluate. In high school, 70% of high school seniors seriously contemplate suicide. When our Guru Maharaj was walking through UCLA, or UC Berkeley campus, University of California, there's a very, very famous big tower. In the 1960s, do you know what that tower was famous for? Students climbing to the top and jumping down to commit suicide. Why? It wasn't due to physical ailments. These were people in their early 20s. They were coming from wealthy families. They had beautiful, healthy bodies. They had the world before them, economically, socially. But they were frustrated. The mental stress was so terrible that they could not even bear living. According to the government of America, the health department, 33% of American adults admit that they have serious mental health problems. When I was a little boy going to school in the 1950s, things were quite peaceful. According to the statistics of the educational system, the three most serious problems in the schools in the 1950s. One, chewing of gum and sticking it under the desk. Serious problem. Two, talking during class. And three, distracting the teacher when they were giving their lessons. Now, at that time, in the 1950s, we only had little black and white televisions. And every time you wanted to change the station, you had to get up, cross the room, and turn a little dial. And it was, in Chicago, the second largest city in America, there was four channels. And as far as if you wanted to listen to music, you had to get one of those big vinyl discs called records, and you had to put a needle on it and make it go around. Now, what is the entertainment? What is the facilities? We have big, big jumbo jet airplanes. As far as television, 100 channels, digital, color. You just sit down and press buttons and you can go anywhere over the world. CDs, so much incredible progress. What were the problems in the 1990s in the schools? One, abuse of drugs, heroin, opium, cocaine, addiction to drugs amongst the students, one of the three problems. Two, pregnancy. Such wild, uncontrolled sex life. One of the three greatest problems in the school is young teenage girls or less getting pregnant. Three, guns. People bringing pistols and dangerous ammunition to school with them and shooting. You remember a couple of years ago, there was a whole series of shootings amongst little children in school, killing their teachers, killing their classmates. Are we actually progressing in our civilization? We shouldn't be blind. We have to evaluate. We have to be introspective. What is actual progress? When there's too much stress, the World Health Organization, they explain, this was in the 1992, I believe, they met, and they came to the conclusion that in the industrial nations, the highly industrialized nations, in proportion to the gross national product of nations, there was a rise in heart disease. In the United States of America, one half of all cardiac arrests are stress-related. Is this advancement of civilization? When there's too much stress physically, there's chance of heart disease, ulcers, indigestion, headaches, fatigue. It's also one of the greatest causes of cancer. Stress related. Mentally, people have nervous breakdowns. People feel utterly frustrated, disillusioned, depressed, suicidal. I believe even in the universities here in India, including IIT, suicide is becoming a problem. Because people don't know how to deal with stress. People do not have a foundational basis in their life that keeps them strong when difficulties come. And difficulties will inevitably come. Behaviorally, stress leads to drug addiction, alcoholism, loss of work, loss of health, massive demand on the economy. It's a big problem. If we're not a part of the solution, we're part of the problem. So today we would like to evaluate what's going wrong. When I was a little boy in the 1950s and 60s, in the place I lived, I never heard of a divorce, except on television. Some movie stars were always getting divorced. But I never saw anybody get divorced. People were faithful. People were responsible. Now, in the 1990s, 71% of all marriages are divorced within the first 3 years. Statistic. And most of the divorces are coming not just from the very, very poor people, but even the highest streams of society. In the upper classes of American society, the majority of people cannot sleep without sleeping pills. Why? Because they're in so much anxiety, they're in so much stress, they're so miserable in their mind. Is that advancement of civilization? When we ask what's wrong, we have to further evaluate our own experiences. We were talking about divorces. 90% of juvenile delinquency are children that come from broken homes. Do you know how much misery a divorce causes? Do you know how much stress it causes in the heart of the husband, the wife, battling it out in the courts, battling it out of the courts, and the poor children who see it? They become unstable and emotionally insecure, usually for the rest of their lives. It's cruelty. And to the degree India imports America's technology and entertainment forms, it also comes along with it all of these reactions to this type of a life. You know, Princess Diana, she believed in reincarnation. She told the press, honestly, that her desire was, in her next life, she would be born in a poor family because she considered she could get more happiness in that situation. Some years ago, I was driving in the car with a person who in the 1970s was the number one television star in America. His show on American television was number one for 7 years consecutively. He was telling me that I own a mansion in Hollywood. I own Mercedes, Toyotas. It's all paid for. When he was working on the television set, he was getting $20,000 a week, plus so much other money coming from commercials and everything like that. He was having sexual relations with the most beautiful movie actresses in all the world every week. They were his co-stars. He was in the class of society that so many millions of people want to be in, with all the big musicians, all the big movie and television stars, all the big politicians. He used to mix with them, drink with them, play with them. He told me that he was miserable. And he said, every one of these big people, I know them intimately, they're all lonely and miserable. When you see them on the stage, they have big, big smiles. He said, why do they smile? Because they're expert actors and actresses. But in their hearts, they're lonely and they're miserable. We were driving in a car in Thailand. And there were some simple people on their hands and knees picking rice with their little hats to keep them from the sun. And he said, I'd rather socialize with those people because they have some real substance to their life. All these big, big people, they're always trying to be someone they're not. They're hollow. They're shallow inside. He looked at me and said, I want what you have. I said, sir, you know, I was hitchhiking on the side of the road walking, and you picked me up in a Mercedes limousine. You're going to stay in the Hilton Hotel in Bangkok, and I don't even know where I'm going to stay. You want to be like me? He said, yes, you have some peace. I have no peace. One of my best friends that I grew up with, his uncle is one of the wealthiest men in Southern California. He owns more real estate in Beverly Hills than anyone. He owns banks, apartment buildings. He owns one of the Los Angeles national basketball teams. Very, very influential, powerful. He has several Rolls Royces. But my friend, his nephew, he tells me he's always in so much stress. He's always so unhappy. He doesn't have any friends he can really trust as friends, although he's in the highest society mixing with them all. Is this success? I'd like to ask all of you a question. What do you hope to gain through your careers and through your lives? Would anyone like to say? Could anyone answer this question? What do you hope to achieve through your life and your career?
Happiness.
Happiness.
Contentment.
Contentment. Money. What else?
Prestige.
Huh?
Migration.
Like the birds.
You want to feel the life.
Huh? Your goal in life is to live like that. Is that? Anyways, who said money? Why do you want money? Huh?
Money gets you everything.
Huh.
It gets you everything. Why do you want everything? Can you answer that question? No, you should know where you're going and why. You want money because it buys anything, everything. Why do you want everything? Because you think it will make you happy? Ultimately, everyone is looking for happiness. And happiness is an internal experience. It's not an external experience. We have given many examples. Some people said prestige. Have you ever heard of Mr. Rockefeller? Does he have prestige? Does he have money? Such a powerful personality. He can decide, this is one of the Rockefellers I'm going to speak of the past generation. When I was a child, there was the biggest of the Rockefellers. His son went on a sociological, anthropological mission to New Guinea to study the man-eating, cannibals. And somehow or other, his ship got wrecked as he was leaving, and they never found him again. He was eaten by the object of his studies. So Mr. Rockefeller wrote in the newspaper, he spoke, that with all my money, with all my prestige, with all my power, with all my influence, I'll never find a day of happiness in my entire life because my son is dead. It's the nature of the world. Anything can happen at any time to anyone. What is the use of having the world and not having happiness? So if we want to understand what is happiness, we have to understand who is it that wants to be happy. According to Bhagavad Gita, the beginning of knowledge is to understand who I am. We have three bodies. We have a gross physical body, and on the gross physical body we have five senses. We can see, we can hear, we can touch, we can smell, we can taste. And there are certain pleasures that can come on the physical body and certain pains that will come on the physical body. Then we have the subtle body, the mind, the intelligence, and the ego, our emotional condition. Mental happiness and mental distress actually have a much more powerful influence than physical happiness and distress. The prostitutes in Bombay, they're having more physical enjoyment than anyone. But they're not happy because they have no peace of mind. They have no inner mental satisfaction. There is also the soul, the Atma. In Sanskrit, Atma means the body, the mind, and the soul. This Atma is you and me, the resident within the home of this body. The Atma is seeing through the eyes, thinking through the brain, hearing through the ears. And the proof is, at the time of death, everything is there except you. The body is like a car. The soul is like the driver of the car, seeing through the window, making sound through the horn, turning left, turning right, going forward, going backward. Similarly, we are driving this body. When we go to sleep, we forget we're this body. We may dream that we're in a whole other place that has nothing to do with this body. That means the soul is identifying itself with its subtle body at the time of dreaming and with the gross body at the time of awakening. Some people say, how can we accept the presence of the soul unless we can see it, unless we can touch it, unless we can taste it? But can you taste, touch, or see your thoughts? Are they real or are they not real? Thoughts are more real than the physical. It's thoughts that's pushing forward the world in whatever direction it's going. People's desires, people's aspirations, people's motivations. It is an invisible power that is very much an essential part of us. Subtler than thought is consciousness. Consciousness is the symptom of the presence of the soul. It is this consciousness that is the source of life. It is the consciousness that is our original and true identity. Vedanta Sutra explains the nature of this consciousness. Anandamayobhyasat. That this Atma, or this conscious force, is always seeking pleasure. And therefore, the whole world, all species of life, are driven by the aspiration for pleasure. The little insects are looking for pleasure. The birds in the sky are looking for pleasure. The fish in the sea are looking for pleasure. The beasts in the forest are looking for pleasure. And all human civilization, regardless of caste, regardless of nationality, regardless of race, regardless of sex, everyone is looking for pleasure. Do you all agree with that? And according to the influences of nature, the three modes of material nature, we're trying to find pleasure in various ways. Some people find pleasure in beating and killing others. Some people find pleasure in just accumulating more and more and more and more wealth, power, and prestige. Some people are seeking pleasure in being very charitable, very kind, very giving to others. People are looking for pleasure in the opposite sex. People are looking for pleasure in family life, in children. Everyone is driven in all circumstances by the pursuit of pleasure. And what interferes with our pleasure more than anything else? Pain. So everyone's trying to avoid pain. If you study our economy, so much money is spent trying to avoid pain. The medical industry, simply trying to ward off suffering. How many billions of dollars is being spent? And then we have the cosmetic industry. It's painful to see yourself look ugly or old. So there's all kinds of cosmetic devices to change and make you, you're actually not young and beautiful, but to make you appear that way. And I've seen old people. They can't fool anybody. But they try to fool themselves. I have seen. They'll put all kinds of makeup and make nice hairs and everything and just look in the mirror thinking, oh, I'm so nice today. I'm so beautiful today. Nobody else believes them. How much is spent on military? Why so much money for military? Building bombs and armies and navies and air force, because it's fear of pain, the pain of losing our property, our land, the pain of losing our lives, the pain of losing our freedom. So everyone is in pursuit of pleasure. This is something that universally every living entity has in common. Why? Because the nature of consciousness is pleasure. Some years ago, I was with Mother Teresa in Calcutta. She told me something very interesting. She said to me that all these people around me, they're poor and they're dying. But when I look in their eyes, I see hope. I see a light in their eyes because they have hope. But when I go to the West, New York, Los Angeles, London, Paris, I go to the wealthiest people. They come to see me, I see them. I don't see that light of hope in their eyes. The biggest problem in the world is hunger. Hunger of the belly is easy to resolve. You just give some food. The real problem is not hunger of the belly. The real problem is hunger of the heart. People are lonely. People are dissatisfied with their lives. People are seeking pleasure. And they'll never be satisfied with the artificial, superficial forms of pleasure that they're indulging in. What the heart is longing for is love. Is there a greater satisfaction than love? Why in the movies, the main theme is love? Why in the songs that people sing all over the world, the main theme is love? It's usually frustrated love. Because actually, that's the greatest pain. In the West, we call it broken heart. When a man loves a woman and a woman loves a man and there's some terrible disturbance, the hearts are broken. You know the story of Romeo and Juliet. They couldn't live with their broken hearts. It was too painful. Love gives the greatest pleasure, and also frustrated love can cause the greatest pain. Because love is the ultimate experience of happiness. Now, superficial acts of love on the physical platform, on the emotional platform, never actually satisfy the soul. When people first meet each other, man and woman, there may be some romance, there may be some infatuation, there may be some sense of the idea of love. But after some time, in the West, they usually divorce, 71% of them, within 3 years. Or in India, where people are more responsible and duty-bound, they don't do that. But basically, after some time, they just tolerate each other and live according to a sense of responsibility for the children, live for the responsibility of the society around. But the soul is looking for ecstasy. Why? Bhagavad Gita explains. And logically, we can also analyze this truth and find something wonderful. That the nature of the soul is it is part of the Supreme Soul, or God. And the nature of the soul is to love. God is Janmadhyashayataha, from whom everything emanates, the complete whole. When the very eternal, natural condition of the soul is awakened to understand its eternal nature and its eternal relationship with the Supreme, then there's complete fulfillment of love. And once you understand your loving relationship with the Supreme Lord, then naturally, automatically, spontaneously, you see every living being in relationship as part of the Supreme. Therefore, there's love. We talk about universal brotherhood, universal sisterhood, but unless we understand the universal Father, how could we actually have this type of unmotivated love? Some people think that if they become spiritually minded, they will become ineffective in their pursuits of a great career. How many of you have thought like this? It's a distraction. If you become peaceful, if you become happy, how will you be motivated to go out into the competitive marketplace and succeed? This is because we don't understand what actually is spiritual life. Spiritual life is the act of expressing the internal wealth and fortune that we have found and sharing it with the world. Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna was a family man. He was a military politician. But he utilized his career to serve society, to express his love of God and his love for all humanity. I want to ask you a question. Which is a greater motivating principle? Greed or love? How many of you feel greed? Raise your hand, please. How many feel love? How much was your mother paid for raising you from your birth? Huh? Mothers, they stay up all night. 24-hour call. It's probably the hardest occupation in the world is being a mother. Simply because there's a sense of love for the child, willing to do anything at any time to protect that child, to give pleasure to that child. Under any condition, even in the face of any impediment, the mother is there if she has love for her child. What this society requires most is not big, big people with big, big degrees, but people who have understood the meaning of love and are willing to share that with the world. And those of you who have big, big degrees and big and very, very great skills and influence, how much you can use that to generate the spirit of love, compassion in this world. Greatness is not in possession, prestige, and power. Greatness is in humility and compassion. And the more we have skills and influence in society, the more we can be instruments of humility and compassion. This is the greatest need. This is the foundation of the future of the world. This is the foundation that's based on truth. If you build your foundation on an illusion, it will crumble. Are we the body or are we the soul? Are we meant for greed or are we meant for love? Are we part of the Supreme or are we just accidental chemical combinations? If we have a spiritual substance, than to awaken our true identity, to actually come to the point of real knowledge, then we have a foundation that's based on truth. And whatever stress comes upon us, we will uphold our dignity, our integrity, and our peace of mind. If you're not happy within, you cannot be happy under any circumstance. Example is given in Bhagavad Gita that an ocean, because of its depth and its size, however many rivers may be flowing into the ocean. Sometimes it's the rainy season, the rivers are flowing in millions of gallons an hour. And during the dry season, hardly anything is coming in. Does the ocean overflow or reduce? Happiness of satisfaction within our own hearts, then whatever situation comes upon us, it can't really disturb us. It can motivate us, but motivate us with the proper integrity, with the proper purpose. Actually, stress is good if it motivates us for the right purpose. It's according to our perception. For a person who understands properly, pressure is a privilege that comes after hard work in order to earn it. If we see it in that way, then pressure is a very positive thing and we respond positively. If we see it as a negative thing, then we will respond negatively. A glass is half full of water. Some people say it's half empty. Some say it's half full. One is discouraging, one is encouraging. It's a question of perception. Our happiness is based on our perceptions. When we perceive in the light of knowledge, then we can see every situation that comes upon us in this world as a wonderful opportunity to do something wonderful. And the more stress, the more difficulty, the more tension, the greater the challenge, the greater the opportunity to serve. So, from the spiritual point of view, stress management is building a foundation of truth within our own consciousness and maintaining ethics, integrity, and happiness under all circumstances. It is natural. In the Western world, and more in India, people are so lonely. They're so bored with life. They have to manufacture so many incredible types of technology just to somehow or other divert their attention from their empty shell lives. What is television? People just sit in front of the television chaining just channels. Most of them do it because they're just lonely in life. They're frustrated with their life. They want somebody else to control their lives, control their consciousness, put you in a fantasy land. You know, according to statistics, when all this high technological television goes into a country, within 3 years, the murder rate increases 15 times. Is that so good? Unless we experience happiness within our own hearts, we will be lonely. And our whole life is just a cosmetic way of trying to forget that loneliness. You are all students of IIT. You are facing great stress every day in your studies, in your families and your society's expectations upon you. You have great futures. My humble request is build the future of your life on the foundation of truth. That we are all eternal spiritual entities. That true love and true peace is within our hearts and can be awakened. Our Guru Maharaj used to say that Krishna consciousness is the original consciousness of every living being. But we have forgotten. If you have a disease and you forget you have the disease gets worse and worse and worse. We should recognize what our disease is and treat it. It will not go away through forgetfulness. We are all seeking pleasure. We are all seeking love. It is within your own heart. There was a famous best-selling book in the West where a man, he was told that his father left as an inheritance a great treasure. The entire book describes how he traveled the entire world looking for that treasure. He died in the process after a whole life of searching. They brought him back to his home where his search originated from. And in digging the grave in his own backyard, they found the treasure. It's a simple story, which is the story of our lives. We're trying to find the treasure of inner happiness. We want to share something wonderful with the world from that treasure. But that treasure is within our own hearts. If you do not find it there, you will find it nowhere else. But the treasure is covered by dirt. The dirt of ego, false ego, the dirt of anger and greed and lust and envy, illusion, the dirt of so many misconceptions and misdirections. If we simply clean the dirt from our consciousness, we will find the ultimate source of all of our aspirations. Love, peace, truth. The chanting of the names of the Lord is one of the great processes that we personally practice, which is a scientific method of actually cleaning the mirror of the heart. The mind is considered to be like a mirror. The soul is seeing through the mind. If the mind is full of debris and dust, then what do you see? You just see debris and dust. But the purpose of the mirror is that you see yourself. But you cannot see yourself unless the mirror is clean. The purpose of all spiritual paths is to clean the mirror of mind so that we can perceive as it is who we are And what is our relationship with God? What is our relationship with all living beings? What is our relationship with this world? These are the most important questions in life, and the answer is within. The chanting of the Maha Mantra, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, is a non-sectarian spiritual formula explained in the Vedas to clean the mirror of the heart, to give us direct perception, direct realization, direct experience of that great treasure of inner happiness. And the greatest, most virtuous purpose of life is to share that treasure in the world through all of our pursuits, through our career, our occupation, through our family, through our social friendships. Today there's so much conflict and war taking place all over the world due to social stress. Even in the name of religion. But actually it has little or nothing to do with religion. Not real religion. The universal principle of all religion is to know one's relationship with God and to be instruments of peace, compassion, and love. We have here Rishikesh Mafatlal. He is a very, very aggressive businessman, traveling around the world, multinational contracts, tens and thousands of employees, struggling against various changes in the market, the economy of India. I believe something like 90% of textile mills closed down due to the changing of the economic laws of the government and so far. So he's struggling. He's working hard. And he's earned, he and his father has earned respect and dignity. Why? Because he's performing his work in a spirit of love and devotion. When the worst crisis was going on in his company, major crisis, he was at our temple dancing and smiling, happy as anything. But then after, in the morning, when it was time to go to his hours, he was like a military general fighting for truth. He makes profits, but he uses his profits to live a holy life and to generate a tremendous amount of charity for the welfare of others and the spiritual upliftment of others. We have one devotee in our temple in Chopati. He is a stock consultant. Yes? And he told me, what's happening in this man's company? I know. I deal with these people. Anybody else would be taking all kinds of antidepressants. They were having sleepless nights. He's smiling and dancing. And he's still working so hard to uphold the company against all odds. But he's peaceful. He's happy. I can't believe it. It's inhuman. He's sitting before us. We have all seen it with our own eyes. A person under the worst possible stress of occupation, financial, is fighting formidably for the prestige, of God, because he dedicates what he has, whatever powers he has in his company, whatever income he has from his company, he dedicates it not only for his spare family's physical, emotional, and spiritual well-being, but as much as possible the whole society. And through it all, maintains peace, maintains love. Why? Because he has a strong spiritual foundation in his life, where he can maintain integrity, respectability, and bliss, even in the most stressful conditions of life. And express his love through his work. Our Guru Maharaj, Srila Prabhupada, he explained that religion without philosophy is either sentimentalism or mental speculation. I mean, sentimentalism or fanaticism. And philosophy without religion is mental speculation. Today, in the name of religion, we see so much fanaticism, so much superstitionism. I've given classes in so many colleges in India, especially in the Bombay area, and I find so many young people, they're rejecting their parents' religions. Or, at the best, they're often just socially going along with it, but they really have no serious conviction. Because they see so many rituals. They see it appears very superstitious. People with Western educations are not so concerned with tradition. They're concerned with progress. They want to know why. As Western education, its very fundamental basis is, I don't believe, prove it. That's the way I was taught in school, not to believe anything unless it is proven. Unless we understand what is spirituality through philosophy, logic, and science, it simply remains either sentimentalism or fanaticism. And people are rejecting these things. And if we simply go into philosophy and logic without understanding the very basis and essence of why, scientifically developed faith. Actually, everybody's life is based on faith. Can't deny it. We don't know we're going to live tomorrow. We continue our studies because we have faith that we're going to go on living. We have faith in who our mother and father is. We have faith in so many things that are beyond our sense perception. We have faith in the authors of our books. Did any of you see face to face Mahatma Gandhi? Many people call him the father of our nation on the basis of faith. Faith in what other people see, faith in what's in the books. But it's reasonable faith because it's logical. There's evidence. So we must understand the nature of the soul, the nature of God, on the basis of logic, on the basis of philosophical evidence. On the basis of experience. That faith, that type of faith, can carry us smoothly across any obstacle, any stressful condition that plummets upon us. There is nothing stronger than a man or a woman that has faith. Faith based on philosophy, logic, devotion, and science. Faith in the spiritual aspect of life, in our eternal nature, in relationship with the Supreme. Our Guru Maharaj would say that America is like a very, very strong man, but blind. Doesn't really know where it's going. Has no real understanding of truth. And therefore we see, this is the activities of a blind man we're talking. We gave many statistics. So much power. So much advancement. So many achievements. But kids are killing each other in the schools. Alcoholism, drug addiction is rampant. So much frustration, so much immorality, broken families. Because they have so much, but they don't know where to go or how to get there. India historically, in recent centuries, has tremendous vision, but lame. Like a lame man with good eyes. A lot of poverty. A lot of inefficient politics. When I was going to school as a young man, I only heard two things about India. That people are dying of starvation and disease, and that people, yogis, lay on nails. That's all. That's all I heard until I came here. Later on, I understood that there's something very, very deep and spiritual that these people of India have. I was born in a wealthy nation, in a wealthy family in America, Chicago area. I traveled by foot from London to India, seeking spiritual vision, because I saw around me there was none. I saw with my own eyes, and the fact that I'm standing here today is the testimony of what I'm speaking. I saw people with big, beautiful cars, nice televisions, big houses, so much money, beautiful roads and highways to drive on. Where I was living, every member of the family had their own telephone, had their own television, had their own bedroom. As soon as they were 16 years old, they had their own automobile. They were going to fine schools. But I saw no meaning to life in any of them. I saw no substance, no real happiness. My parents were saying to me, just make money, get good job, have nice family, you'll be happy. And I said to them, everyone around me has all those things, but no one's happy. There must be something more to life than this. I came to India to find that. And what a wonderful thing there is in this great spiritual heritage, this great spiritual culture, to give the world vision. If the lame man gets on the shoulders of the blind man, the two of them together can do such great things moving forward in this world. Western science, Western technology, Western education, combined with the vision, the spiritual substance of this great Indian culture, is the combination that can create major changes for the positive throughout this planet. The United Nations can make some temporary makeshift adjustments, but unless the greed, the pride, the envy in the heart is cured, unless we use technology, use education to transmit love and truth and real knowledge, we can't make any real improvements in our world. The world's under stress. So many of the most sacred fundamental principles of civilization are crumbling before our eyes. Even in the wealthiest countries in the world. And nobody knows really what to do. Most people don't even want to think about it. But all of you, by the grace of God, you have the opportunity to utilize your very empowered education, influence, and talents as an expression of pursuing truth and expressing peace and love in your lives. In my very sincere and humble opinion, there is not a more suitable assembly of people in the world than you to actually do something wonderful for your lives, for your families, and for the world. At the time of death, where will the soul go? That is a major question that a sincere person will ask. And not only our own souls, but those of all people around. This world has plenty of money, plenty of technology. The greatest lack is compassion, based on knowledge. Please, please, help manage the stressful condition of life individually and collectively by living for truth and love. Thank you very much. How did you learn to do it in engineering? How did you learn to strengthen foundations in the field of engineering? You learned from authorized books? Yes? You learned from authorized professors? And they convinced you, and they taught you various sciences and how to apply them to your particular projects in the same way. There are the holy scriptures. There are the holy teachers who actually simply repeat. A professor doesn't simply give his own opinion. A professor is meant to actually teach you the science. Yes? Well, similarly, that is what a guru is. Not someone who gives magic shows, but a person who simply repeats the great science, the science of spirituality. By this chanting of the names of the Lord, by the chanting of Hare Krishna, which is what we do, it actually uncovers that great spiritual foundation that's already there, which can, and once that spiritual foundation is there, it can uphold the integrity of our consciousness under any circumstances. also living according to moral and ethical principles in our life, learning to live in a spirit of service rather than exploitation, compassion rather than envy and hatred, learning to live in a spirit of service. That is the nature of the soul. That is Sanatana Dharma. Sanatana Dharma is to serve God and all living entities in knowledge and realization. So this is a very brief explanation, but if we are serious about the subject matter, then we will approach the proper teachers and the proper literatures by which we can actually understand and realize this most important of all subjects. Gita says, Raja Vidya Rajaguyam Pavitram Vidyam Uttama. There are many types of knowledge, but the king of knowledge is to know who you are. If you know so much, but you don't know who the knower is, there's something deficient there, and there will be no satisfaction. But with all you know, if you learn, who is it? Who is it that is knowing? Who am I? And what is the ultimate eternal purpose of my life? And use your knowledge for that purpose. Then your knowledge, your abilities, will bring about the greatest satisfaction in life to you and to others. Does that answer your question, sir? Thank you. Yes? What would you like to do? Truth is utilizing our talents, our knowledge, our strength, our intelligence, utilizing everything we have for the highest purpose. The highest purpose is to express love and to serve God. So there is incomplete understanding of renunciation to give up our occupation when it can be used for this higher purpose. The real art of living and the art of loving is to understand the science of how to integrate our spiritual ideal with our physical, social, emotional, mental, and occupational activity. That will bring eternal, everlasting meaning, substance, and joy to whatever we do. Does that answer your question?
If one comes to the same thing, if you want to enjoy the whatever work we are doing, if we go down, how do we judge that? What should we do?
By developing a good spiritual foundation, then it becomes natural. Real happiness is not in taking, it's in giving. People whose hearts are empty, hollow, and starving they're selfish. They're egoistic. Sometimes even cruel. Because they need to do those things. A person whose heart is full and rich in happiness and peace and spiritual satisfaction, that person wants to give, wants to serve. To exploit due to egoistic and selfish purposes. You may conquer the world, but you'll never find a moment of real satisfaction within. So use your career with spiritual understanding in the service of God, in the service of humanity. And then your career will actually give you the greatest, most profound happiness. What we're speaking is how to actually find real happiness within your life. You are educated. You have a whole life of work ahead of you in your career, perhaps. Use it for the highest purpose, and you'll find the greatest satisfaction. Clean your heart and express your inner virtues through everything you do. That is the perfection of life. Yes?
You said that you said that you welcome some debate. I can see that there are too many doubts. We all have doubts all our lives. You know, trying to say many, many things, and a number of people in the audience perhaps have questions. Not everybody has raised many questions. Because they hear often cliches. I mean, I'm not saying that the word art of living, for example, you emphasized it. I mean, one thing that was missing, I think, if you just add that young people have need to learn creativity. That one single word, your focus, if it was focused in to learn creativity, a poet, a scientist, a writer, or there can be creativity in any area. If you learn creativity, not be dissatisfied with your work. And that's the heart of living. I mean, Indian saints have said it, Kabir has said it, many poki patpat de mua. I mean, this is so many proverbs.
Creativity is one of the great needs of every human being for satisfaction. But creativity is not the foundation. Creativity is something you build upon a foundation. Because Adolf Hitler was a very creative man. He was one of the most creative men in history. I mean, he had such incredible ideas. He wrote whole books about how he wanted to create an entire society. But it was based on cruelty, envy, and hatred. Therefore, his creativity was the cause of the death and suffering of tens of millions of people's lives. He was a million times more creative than practically anyone else. That's why he was able to destroy millions of people's lives with his creative ideas of how to set up a government, how to set up military, how to make concentration camps, how to kill innocent people. That was creative as anything. Did you ever read about the concentration camps in the Nazi countries? How they enslaved people, how they took their teeth out, how they tortured them, how they made them workers, how they killed them, how they disposed of their body. That's creativity. But it was based on hatred. It was founded on an unclean, contaminated heart. That's not the art of living. You don't think it was creative, those people that crashed into the World Trade Center on September 11th? That was one of the most creative masterpieces of terror in history. That was creative as anything. But are we celebrating such creativity? Is that the art of living? So yes, we should be creative. But our creativity should be based on the foundation of love, peace, and knowledge of God and the soul. Then we can actually use our creative powers to do something really and truly wonderful and beneficial for ourselves, our family, and all the world. Thank you.
I mean, most of the people are just bored. That's one of the reasons for stress, and that's all I was trying to point out. The boredom, the feeling of boredom, will not be there if you have the right kind of creativity, and of course, creativity must be channeled from body, as you said.
Swamiji, I am somewhat confused about the spiritual things and all. If I am doing in such an early age, if I am moving towards the spiritual things, I am reading Bhagavad Gita and all sort of stuff, spiritual stuff. I am going deep into that, I am leaving material world. And I am just totally find myself that whatever I am going to do is not going to be useful for my life. But if you are moving towards into this, you will go deep into the spiritual world and you will leave whole world. And Bhagavad Gita says that you have a responsibility towards your parents. Mm. And my parents want myself to be something in certain stage. And I am going away from that. If I am moving towards the spiritual, my parents will never want me to be a sadhu or mahatma sort of thing. They will never think of that. But even if I am reading this Bhagavad Gita and all sort of stuff, I am really confused. I am not really seriously, these things are really good. Whatever you are telling is really good, but is it really? Means how will you satisfy yourself? And Bhagavad Gita says that your personal, your first responsibility is towards your mother. You only said that if what mother does, nobody can does. If I am not able to satisfy my mother, how can I satisfy my God and all? Whatever we can say, how can I satisfy Krishna? So I am really confused. I will lose my career, I will lose everything, I will go away from my parents, I will go away from my society. I have a lot of expectation from my society, but how can I justify it by doing all this stuff? And it's very difficult to do this stuff and that one. That's totally different. That's technical stuff. You will do that one. If you are going in Switzerland, you will move towards that side and you will never come back. That's sure. You will never come back. Been very far and then again come back. In that I lost 1 year. And I was satisfied only. But behind my parents and family, everybody was not satisfied. Mm. And whatever I think is my parents are for the most means. Even Krishna comes and says me, no, I will never go against my parents and my mother and whatever. So how can I justify, how can I satisfy myself by learning spiritual things and even learning technical things and correlating? I'm giving 100% to society. Mm. So I want some things so that I can satisfy myself. Thank you.
Thank you. Very creative question. And you seem to be very happy asking this question. Let me ask you a question. If you were the chief executive officer of a company like Mufflinlal Industries, would your parents tolerate that? Would they be completely unhappy if you had a post like that? Answer the question. Huh? They'll be satisfied. You're saying that you don't want to be a sadhu, you don't want to be a mahatma. But here sitting next to you is a sadhu and mahatma who happens to be the chief executive officer of Mufflinlal Industries. I'm not just speaking some theoretical conceptualization. speaking reality. He's sitting right, you can see him. You can shake hands with him if you want. You can touch him. He's living, according to Bhagavad Gita, he's living as a sadhu and a mahatma. He has a wife and three beautiful children. He has a father and mother. They're proud of him. He has a big company. He's doing so much welfare for all human society, physically, emotionally, spiritually. Why? Because he's living according to the teachings of Gita. Gita doesn't teach that you have to leave the world. We have to leave the exploitative, envious, greedy nature. And Gita teaches, work within the world. Actually, there are so many different occupational needs in society. One time I was speaking in a college and somebody asked, Swamiji, this is all impractical. It was an engineering college. They said, what if everyone became a sadhu like you? Who would grow the food? Who would build the houses? Who would do the business? Who would protect the citizens? Huh? So I answered with a question. What if everyone in the world became an engineer like you? There's a need for doctors, lawyers, especially lawyers in this day and age. There is a need for mothers and fathers. There's a need for teachers and professors. There's a need for architects and politicians and military. There's a need for dressmakers. There's a need for every type of occupation within this world. There's also a need for people in the renounced order who are trying to enlighten people in whatever they're doing. Becoming God conscious is not to become a Swamiji. There is a need in society for Swamijis to remind everybody else of how they're supposed to be living. However, someone like Mr. Muffatlal, by his actions, by his work, he is reminding people. So no, don't leave the world. Live in the world on the foundation of truth. You really want to do something for your parents? Do the greatest thing for your parents. Because your parents, they have a body which they're living in temporarily. They have an emotional system, but essentially your parents are eternal souls, part of God. What are you doing for their souls? You may be doing something for their body and mind, but if you want to do complete and full service, do something for their body, mind, and soul. By this practice of your own spirituality, you can do something wonderful. You can give great wealth and love to their souls. And that will be a really satisfying, complete honor of your mother and father. Everyone has to die. What about their soul? What are you going to do about their soul after they leave this world? Anything we do in the service of God with a clean consciousness, all those we love reap the benefits of our devotion. That is an eternal spiritual truth. So rather than an incomplete offering of love, let us offer our parents, our loved ones, what to speak of all living beings. Let us try to utilize our lives in such a way that we can give as complete and as compassionate and as loving an offering as we can for them. That is what a Mahatma is. don't leave the world. Leave worldliness. And live in the world in a spirit of truth, compassion, and love. Share that with your parents. Share that with everyone. I became a Swamiji. Where are you from, sir? Chitrakoot. If you're from Chitrakoot, your parents know what a sadhu is. Yes? They know what Swamiji is. Now, 10,000 miles away in northern Illinois in America, they never heard of a sadhu or a Swamiji. In 1972, I came back from India, and all my parents saw me like this. They were shocked, stunned. They had no understanding. They've never seen anything like this. They thought I came from some other planet. They were thinking maybe some UFO kidnapped me and made me like this. They didn't know what to think. And they were very much disturbed because I wasn't living the kind of life that they expected. But after they understood how I'm trying to help humanity, the philosophy and the scientific principles I live by, after meeting people like Mr. Muffatlal and hundreds of other people who are also saintly Mahatmas, who are here as R.K. Maheshwari, Mahaprabhu Das. He's a high court advocate, a lawyer in the Indian judicial system. His house is a temple. Every Friday night, over 100 people come to hear him speak Bhagavad Gita and others. He's, for the past 25 years, been practicing the life of a Mahatma. He has a wife. He has two children. He's carried on his responsibilities, and he's fought in the, like a warrior, he'll fight in those courts. But the influence that he gains through his career, he tries to actually help people's lives. His brothers, his mother, his whole family are lovers of Krishna. So many dozens and dozens of people have developed real meaning and happiness and purpose in life by his influence. And he doesn't have a shaved head. He's wearing American suit and tie.
He's coming from court.
He came directly from the courts to here. He's a Mahatma. So my parents, after meeting people like this, and after seeing what the content of what I'm trying to do for God and the world, they have such great pride, such great satisfaction in my life. Of all my brothers, they say they're most proud of me because I'm trying to do something very wonderful for the world. Of course, I'm really hardly doing anything. I'm so insignificant. But the nature of mother and father, they always see the good in their children. So please, my dear sir, understand that if you live a holy life and you express that holiness in your worldly activities, you will be doing the greatest service for your mother and father and for all humanity. Does that answer your question?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Swami, my question is not directly related to this space of individual, but it's one of the biggest challenges facing India today, the problem of religious fanaticism or fundamentalism, which we have seen during the last decades, particularly the, after the Ajanta crisis. Even we recently saw the Godra incident and the aftermath of the Gujarat violence. All this is always a religious fanaticism and fundamentalism. Between these two common between Hindus and the Muslims. Now, what, according to you, a rational solution for the Ajanta crisis? Because that secular fabric, the constitutionally guaranteed the secularism in India is at stake at the time. What is the solution for the Ajanta? One is the court is what the court decides, and other is the negotiation between the two communities. Now, do you think the two communities will really go to negotiate and make some compromise, or will look forward to the court decision?
These problems.
And this is, I think, it is a stress for India, no?
Yes, yes. Not only India, the whole world. Because, you know, there's nuclear bombs on, in so many hands in the world today. So the whole world is very, very much affected by whatever happens within the global family, especially in this 21st century. I do not see it as a problem of religion. I see it as a problem of irreligion in the close of religion. We have to define what is real religion. Real religion doesn't mean being a Hindu, a Muslim, a Jew, a Christian, a Zoroastrian, a Jain, a Buddhist. These can be very much social, ethnic, egoistic identities. Real religion is that process that awakens one's love of God. And where there was the awakening of love of God, there is the qualities of tolerance, peace, compassion, mercy, self-control, forgiveness. These are the universal qualities of anyone who loves God, whether they be a Hindu, a Muslim, a Christian, a Jew, Zain, Zoroastrian, whatever religion. These are the qualities of love. This is the qualities of religion. Where we find these qualities, we find religion. Where we find sectarianism, envy, cruelty, that is not religion. What people are fighting about is politics, an ethnic ego, not religion. If any of these people understood what is really in their scriptures, they would not be hating another person because of their external belief. If a man comes home from work and has a dog, sometimes he's dressed in a three-piece suit like Mahaprabhu does, R.K. Maheshwari. Sometimes he comes home wearing a gumsha. He's just gone swimming. Sometimes he comes in his pajamas. Yes? Now, that person's dog will recognize his master in whatever dress he has. Is that true? So, if our master is God, whether he appears as Krishna or Allah or Ram or Jesus, if we love our master, we'll recognize him in all these different appearances. If we don't recognize our master in the different appearances he may have, that means we are less than a dog. Does that answer your question? Rational solution.
A solution to this problem. I can understand, but how how you make understand those people who are just misusing the religion with politics?
Of course, the government is trying their best to do something. Different activist groups are trying their best to do what the
government of India is doing nothing, frankly and honestly speaking. They are looking only for vote and politics. Now people are looking forward, persons like you. You are people from ISKCON or Ramkrishna Mass or something. You people really represent what is interesting. Not those. I'm not taking those organizations in the name of the government.
The greatest thing any of us can do, individually and collectively, I understand your question, is by our words, by our examples, to educate people. There must be education, spiritual education, based on truth, based on true, universal, eternal religious principles. People must be educated by our words and especially by our examples. An example is the best sermon. People learn more by what we do than what we say. One of the greatest reasons why people lose faith in a religion is because people speak very nicely, but they act very differently. So in whatever field of life we may be, whether we're lawyers or businessmen or engineers or housewives, if we live according to the principles of love, of devotion, if our foundation is based on scientific, true spiritual principles, and we come together as far as possible with like-minded people to generate that understanding, then we can offer the best we have for the betterment of society and solution to the problem. I'm a small man. There's not much I can do in such a gigantic problem as you're speaking of. But it is the duty of every living being, however big or small they may be, to try to make a difference, to bring about truth, peace, and love within the world. And that you can do. And we all have that responsibility as human beings. And the more people are convinced of this and influenced by this, the more we can make a great impact on the whole nation.
Hare Krishna.
As you said, if you want to have real happiness, love should be the motivating factor. Mm-hmm. Personally, I'm always very helping, caring and loving towards others. I always try to make this world a better place to live. But still, there are times when I'm not happy. I'm usually puzzled by people's remarks around me. This is life. What you give, you don't get it in the time. So I'm very loving, but I don't find people that way, always. So I'm not always happy. Love you don't love is the motivating factor. But still, I'm not happy. I'm always helping, I'm always loving, but I'm not happy. So what should I do?
You should become happy.
I am happy and cheerful most of the times. But there are times when I'm not happy.
The way to become happy.
Because I get present by people's remarks around me.
Yes, yes. That is the topic of tonight, stress management. When people criticize us or misjudge us or accuse us, that's stressful. It's stressful to our mind, stressful to our ego, causes us pain. If we learn how to actually love people in the fullness and the richness of our souls, then we can actually become transcendental to the dualities of this life. We may have a sentimental conception of love. There's a very simple analogy. If a person is drowning in the ocean and you go swim out risking your life, and you take that person's hat and coat and bring it back to the shore, and the person drowns. Is that love? No. Ah, yes. So similarly, simply by expressing our love for the materialistic clothes, which means the body and the mind, is not real love. What about the person, the soul? Unless you know the soul, how can you love the soul? Unless you know your own soul, how can you know anybody else's soul? So real love begins with knowledge and realization of our true self. Then we can actually love people in fullness. We can actually love the person, not just the clothes they're wearing. When we actually experience that love and express that love, then there's actual real satisfaction. Hate the disease. Don't hate the diseased. People may act in all kinds of abominable and senseless ways in this world. It's due to the disease of ignorance they're acting this way. But every living being is a pure, kind-hearted, every living being, there's love of God within their heart. There's compassion. There's mercy. There's peace within every living being's heart. Every living being is part of God. They're our brothers, our sisters. Why should we hate them? But some are suffering a terrible fever due to ignorance, and they're acting in all kinds of abominable and senseless ways. So we should hate the disease, but we should love the diseased. And we should try to, according to our capacity, by our words, by our example, by our life, try to treat that disease. That is compassion. That is love.
Yes. Can I try to rephrase the reply in one sentence? I just wanted to say...
There's one lady that's been... Her hand's been up for a long, long time. We can speak after, but she's been waiting a long time.
So, I would like to ask one question. Some countries or some people, they are attacking on us. Then what should be the solution? We should go with peace, or we should go with military, like U.S.?
I didn't quite hear you, I'm sorry. Can you speak in the microphone a little slower? Because I'm coming from a foreign country. So if you could speak slowly, I'll understand better.
My question is, if somebody or some nation attacks on one country or nation, then what should be the solution? That country who has done attack,
that country is getting attacked. What should
be the solution? That country which is facing attack, that
should go with
peace, or that should go with military,
like U.S.
U.S.
has been in Afghanistan.
What was the last word?
U.S.
Afghanistan. Oh, Afghanistan. Ah. We have the ethical God-given right to protect ourselves if we are attacked. And sometimes violence is required for peace when there is an aggressive attack. Some years ago, there was a very famous proponent of pacifism and nonviolence. And a journalist approached this person and said, if I come to violate the chastity of your daughter, and the only way you can stop me is by physical violence, will you stop me? He said, under no circumstance will I resort to violence. Person said, even if it means your daughter is raped, you will not stop me? with your fists? He said, no, under no circumstance will I resort to violence. The journalist said, that is violence. To stand by and allow that person to rape your daughter, that is violence. To take a weapon or your fists and fight against that person, that is nonviolence. That is peacefulness. Because we have the right. It is the duty of a government to protect the innocent citizens. Not to conquer aggressively, but to protect, to defend. Sometimes in the process of defending the innocent, you have to attack those who are aggressive. That's basic. That's what politics is about. But that is justified. Today, due to lack of compassion, if someone sees a person beating an old lady in the street, people will just walk by because they don't want to get involved. That is violence. If you see somebody else is suffering due to the violence of another, if you don't do anything about it, you're part of that violence. It's your duty to stop that person. So if anyone is attacking your home, attacking your nation, you have the ethical rights to protect yourself. Does that answer your question?
What is yoga in your perception? Is it having any relation with stress management? Yoga.
Yoga literally means to reunite the consciousness with the supreme consciousness.
Is it a spiritual base or?
The word religion comes from the Greek word religio, which means to bind back or to reunite. The word yoga means to reunite. So religion and yoga are synonymous. To reunite or bind back our consciousness with its source or with God, with our true selves. So this is the most efficient and effective type of stress management. In essence, we don't have to write hundreds and thousands of literatures on the subject of stress management. The solution to stress is very simple. When you're satisfied within your heart, you're immune from stress. When you're satisfied within the heart, no matter how much stress comes, you'll react in a positive way. But it will not create unnecessary disturbance. Stress is harmful when we have no real internal satisfaction within our heart. The purpose of yoga is to give us an internal satisfaction that is transcendent to all of the various circumstances that we may be confronted with in this world of uncertainty. Najayate mriyate vakadachin. The soul is eternal. It is not born. It never dies. It is transcendent. When we realize the soul, the inner satisfaction of that, we deal with the stressful conditions of the world. But at the same time, we're beyond it. That is yoga. That is religion, to attain that state, to realize what is within. Yoga doesn't simply mean doing Shirshasana or Vajrasana. These are helpful. The Hatha Yoga system is helpful for harmonizing the body, the mind, and the soul. Pranayama is helpful for the mind. Jnana, dhyana, helps to harmonize the mind, the intelligence, and the concentration. But according to Gita, bhakti, bhakti means devotion. It is devotion, it is love, that is the eternal nature of the soul. And the perfection of yoga, Gita says, yoginamapi saravisham madgatenantaratmana. Whatever yogic processes we may follow, the perfection of yoga is to unleash the realization of the eternal, blissful state of love that is within our heart, and to express that in everything we do. That is the perfection of yoga. To integrate our love of God, our eternal bliss, in every aspect of our life. Does that answer your question? Yes, sir.
My respect for all the senses in the lotus feet, I very humbly and respectfully place two words in your consideration. You have very nicely explained the problems which our society is facing by giving the simile of the foundation of the building starts from the plinth level, and it has to be strong from the plinth level. The foundation of our life starts from the childhood. Right after birth, the mothers have to lay the foundation. That is the plinth of our life, and I therefore suggest that we should do something to make our foundation strong from the plinth level. Therefore, teachings which you have said to them exposed to the school correctly should be started in all schools, so that our future parents are fully conscious of this, and they raise the future generations since childhood.
In reply,
another point I wanted to make was,
could I just reply to that? Could I reply to that point first, please? Mr. Muffetlal, one of the projects that he's been working so much on is developing a school specifically for that purpose. He's been put for the last year and a half, he's put tremendous amount of effort and his money as well. And not only money is only one thing, but his heart, his concern, his active participation. The school is in Kandivali, yes? And it's his idea is it will have all qualified teachers who have gone through colleges and learned to be accredited teachers. But they're all devotees of the Lord. They all have one aim, to give their children not only the best possible academic education, but the best possible spiritual education and the best possible spiritual influence all around them in school. Last year it went nursery, junior, kinder, KG, and senior KG. This year it will go up to fourth standard, and within 2 years it will go all the way up till 10th standard. The name of the school is Gopal's Garden. The idea of Gopal's Garden is all the children are the flowers in growing in Gopal's Garden. And we want these flowers to grow and bring great beauty and fragrance to the whole society. So as far as changing the entire educational system in India, we would be very happy if we had that power. But here's a particular man who's sharing your feelings and trying to create a very, very, according to capacity, a means by which our very, very young children can be brought up, educated, and trained to be very beautiful flowers, to give fragrance and beauty to the world.
And one more point I wanted to make was, why so many in the audience today are expressing perplexity, confusion, and conflict with what you have told them and what they have learned from them? That is because the foundation is new. They have learned something different from their childhood. And now they are learning something different, truth, which is very fundamental. They understand that, yes, this is the real truth. And therefore, they should recognize why they are getting confused or perplexed. And therefore, remove that confusion. See clearly what is truth. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
What the happiness of true life? How do you recognize it? Whether I'm enjoying it or not? For example, if I'm writing some exams continuously and getting very good marks, and I'm getting admission into a very nice college, which is having high reputation. So, in that sense, I'm feeling very happy with my life on an average. There may be some times I'm very, but I'm worthy. But on an average, I'm feeling very happy with my life. Is the happiness is the true happiness of the true life? How do you define it?
The nature of the soul is such as ananda, eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss. Real happiness in life is to realize that. The transient temporary happiness of getting good marks, of getting good education, never really fulfills any of the needs of the soul. And they are temporary. You get good marks, you're happy. You get bad marks, you're unhappy. You get admission into a very, very big college, you're happy. But then if you're walking down the street and you hit your toe against a brick, you're totally miserable. I was with a man, beautiful marble mansion, so much incredible wealth, everything the world could offer. But the person had a boil on his foot, and he was totally suffering, totally miserable, just crying in pain. There's people living on the street who don't have anything, but they're happier because they don't have a boil on their foot. So real happiness is not this transient, temporary happiness that is subjected to the circumstances around us. Real happiness is the happiness of realizing the eternal, blissful nature of the soul. And by chanting this Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, and following spiritual principles, this original eternal happiness within us is awakened. It's not a matter of superimposing happiness upon us. It's already there. In fact, do you know what the root meaning of education is? You are in the highest institute of education in all of India. Do you know the meaning of education? How many of you know? This is a fundamental question. You're dedicating your life, so much of your energy for education. Do you know the meaning of education? That is not the meaning of education. Education comes from the Latin word educare. Educare means to bring out what is within yourself. Real education is not just superimposing all kinds of data upon our brain for from outside sources. Real education, according to the original definition of the word education, educare, is to bring out what is within ourselves. What is within ourselves? Knowledge and realization of the eternality, blissful nature of the soul, its relationship with God, its relationship with all living beings, and its relationship with this world. That's education. And the academic education that we're learning here should be used to support that education, the real truth of the essence of education. That is the foundation. Build that foundation. Realize, understand that foundation that's within you, and then build upon it in a glorious way. Whether it's bachelor's degree, master's degree, PhD, doctoral degree, build on it in wonderful ways, but let it be based on the foundation of the real meaning of education, to know yourself, to know God. Yes, there was another question here. Microphone is coming. I'm sorry, I didn't know you. This will be last question.
Samiji, stay and confront yourself about that. How can complacency and expectation go together? How can complacency and expectation go together?
And expectation, how they can go together?
Satisfaction and expectation go together?
Satisfaction and expectation.
Satisfaction and expectation? How can they go together? They can go together very nicely. How? That is one of the great mysteries of life. We should understand the meaning of love. The meaning of love is not something that is stagnant, impersonal, or void. The meaning of real love is dynamic, active. If the mother has a sense of love for the child, does she sit in Padmasana going, "Om," when the child is crying? Is that love? It means being active. The child is expecting, and you are expecting to do something for the child. The child is expecting something from you. That reciprocation is love. Love is a dynamic thing. Therefore, real satisfaction comes through service, through selfless giving of ourselves for the pleasure of God and for the welfare of others. Therefore, in spiritual consciousness, satisfaction, expectation, simultaneously, it's harmonized. Our expectation is not to exploit. Our expectation is to serve. In that spirit of service, there is perfect harmony and satisfaction. Does that answer your question? Full audience. And the fact that you tolerated me for so long is your virtuous nature. And it has really been a very special and wonderful privilege and honor for me to have had the chance to try to serve you in whatever small way I was able to serve you. Thank you very much. Sincere and humble prayer that each and every one of you can realize the greatest blessing of spiritual prosperity and happiness in your lives and in everything you do. Thank you very much. With maturity comes greater wisdom and discrimination. A preacher should discriminate, and at the same time should not discriminate. Lord Nityananda Prabhu would give the mercy of Lord Chaitanya to everyone and anyone without discrimination. However, we only have limited time available in our life, so we should, as far as possible, offer Krishna consciousness to everyone and anyone without that discrimination. However, according to a particular person's response, we should discriminate of how much time and energy we should spend. According to a person's receptivity, we should try to give them as much as possible. If a person is not very receptive, the fact is there's thousands and thousands of people who potentially are receptive. So we don't want to give too much time to that person. But if a person is really receptive and actually hearing, and you see that the words of Guru and Gauranga is actually making change in their heart, then we should give them as much as time as possible. Preaching is like being a farmer. You sow your seeds. If there's fertile soil, then you give much water, because you know that, because you can see that the seed will grow very nicely. But if the soil is very dry and very unfavorable, then why should we waste our water on that soil? So put the maximum amount of the water of your time where you see there is a fertile heart that's actually responding. And to others, you preach until you can actually see how much receptive they will be. Of course, in this world, you never know. Sometimes the least likely is the person who will become the most serious. We have seen this on so many occasions. We're preaching to a group of people, so many people are interested, and the person who's the most antagonistic, the person who's least interested, is the person who surrenders their life, and the others remain favorable. So therefore, we should give everyone the chance. We shouldn't give up on anyone. Therefore, even people who are not very favorable, if they're willing to hear from us, we should give them. But with our discrimination, it appears that they're not really responding. So just give them a little and go on to the next person. Give them little and go on to the next. Give them little, go on to the next person. People who are receptive, give them more and more and more and more and more.
as we develop in our wisdom, we also develop in our compassion. Ultimately, Krishna within the heart, if it's really sincere to help people in Krishna consciousness, Krishna in our heart is the person who really gives us the discrimination. We must use the capacity of our intelligence to do so, and ultimately depend on Krishna, because after all, we are simply the instruments of Paramatma by repeating the words of the spiritual masters. But a devotee should not be discouraged. Sometimes we spend so much time with someone and then there's absolutely no apparent results. But with earnest desire, we have tried to help that person. That is a success of our life. Preacher should never be discouraged. Even if we give a person so many hours, days, and years, and then they turn against us, that should not discourage us. Everyone has their free will. But we tried. We tried to serve Sri Guru and Gauranga by delivering the message of bhakti. That is the success of our life. And we do not know what the effect will be. We have heard so many stories about preachers and book distributors. There's one person I know who devotees preached to him very nicely. Never gave up intoxications. Never actually chanted 16 rounds. But over a matter of about 20 years, has preached to so many people. Probably about 30, 40 full-time devotees came through him. So he never became a devotee. But he would just say some little things to people wherever he would go. He would go to places where everyone was taking drugs or having illicit activities. And he'd go there and just talk about how nice Krishna is and invite people to the temple. And they would become devotees and he wouldn't become a devotee. So preaching is a great miracle and a great mystery. When we sow our seeds, we do not know how they will grow, where they will grow. Therefore, we just keep sowing seeds. Of course, where we see a person is taking genuine and sincere interest, we want to give them as much association and as much opportunity as possible. Answer your question. Yes.
We have so many devotees from the world. All of us here, we take maximum. Yeah. I want to know that how we can take the maximum benefit of the such a decision like we have in IIT. All the devotees meet 3 times a day, but sometimes we just become comprehensive, okay, like that. And also, like we have in Bombay, association of all the devotees there, so we don't know in the future will be how what moves we can have and how to take the maximum benefit of. How do we can increase our love?
We are depending on the association of devotees. Srila Prabhupada stated that one who thinks they can be Krishna conscious without the association of devotees is insane. We desperately need the association of devotees, especially in a place like IIT. There is so many various energies that are influencing you to a materialistic life based on greed and pride. is this true? And in a very, very subtle and powerful way, at universities, especially universities which are of a high reputation and a high caliber of academics. People go to these universities due to pride and greed. And that energy is so powerful. It's such a motivating force. So when we're going to a college like this, we're practically throughout the day right in the midst of such energies. Whether they speak on these subjects or not is not really what is important, but it's the motivating factor of most of the people that are here. And every person is generating the particular influence of the energies of their consciousness. So there is a very subtle and tremendously powerful energy. While we were here, Gauranga Prabhu was showing me different halls that were donated by people who gave $40 million and $50 million. These people, they have such tremendous amount of energy for money, 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 money. Success, success, success. So you should understand that you are right in the heart of Maya's front lines. And in order for you to survive, you really need the support of the Vaishnavas. When you're in a battle and you're being shot at with rockets and bullets, you understand in those front lines that I need my fellow comrades. If we do not defend each other, none of us can survive. In Kashmir now, how many soldiers are lined up on the Indian side? About 700,000? Why don't they just send one man to fight against the Pakistani army? Huh? Why don't they send one man? Because it's unrealistic. Every one of those soldiers knows that I'm dependent on every other one of them for my survival. That's the way war is. You cannot fight a war alone. Whatever disagreements, whatever personality differences may be there between us, somehow we're all fighting for the same cause. And if we're not united, we fall. Prabhupada said, divided we fall, united we stand. Actually, the United States is the most powerful nation in the world. Yes? Materially, militarily. But it's interesting that U.S. means the United States. The reason why they're so powerful is because they're united. 50 states. Previously, every state was its own province, its own country. Little by little, they all joined up and became united. California, New York, 3,000 miles away, but united. So the power of the unity of all these states has produced the most powerful material nation in the world. So every time you praise U.S., you're talking about the strength of unity for a material purpose. So Srila Prabhupada explained, if we want, just as unity spreads that material power, unity will also spread spiritual power. What was previously, the greatest competitor with the United States was the Soviet Union. Huh? What does union mean? Union means unity. It was a vast tract of land, the Soviet Union. They were united with a cause. And because of their unity, they had such great power that even the United States was trembling. During the time of Hitler, when he was moving forward, he was, because of the unity of his forces, under his vision, they had such tremendous power. And at one time, India was subjugated by the most powerful nation in the world in the previous generations. And what was that? The United Kingdom. Yes? It is said that the United Kingdom, that the sun never set on the British Empire, because they had conquered lands in every part of the world, in every time zone. It was a united kingdom. So where there is unity, there is strength in the material existence. And this principle holds just as much in spiritual matters. So factually, in this IIT, there's a very united effort to make people the best possible materialistic experts in all of India, and send them all over the world. And they're sending such huge amounts of money back, because they feel a sense of unity to this place. Yes? Otherwise, why are they sending money back? So we are on the battlefield. And Maya has united her forces all over the world, locally, nationally, internationally. She has united powers. She has everyone convinced of her message. And we're just little devotees trying to fight against that influence. It's impractical and impossible to do it alone. Therefore, we need each other. And even a small group of people can have a major impact if they are united, if they are well trained. In the military, there's these special forces. Special forces are usually not big, they're just teams of really well trained people. There are certain special forces in the United States Army where they spend literally millions of dollars training each single person. And when there's some critical battle, these special forces may only be about 20 or 30, but they could do more damage to the enemy than 700,000 soldiers. Because they're so well trained. They know right to how, they know exactly how to go right to the heart of things and infiltrate and destroy. But those special forces, how much they depend on each other for their survival and their success. So here at Shamcharan Prabhu's training camp, you are special forces. And you need each other. You require each other. Of course, unlike the military battles of this world, we don't see the people as our enemies. We see the energy that they represent as our enemy. We see the people as all potential comrades. Everyone is essentially on Krishna's side. But due to this forgetfulness, they have created such a force, incredible force. So we have to use our good intelligence to understand how much we desperately need each other for our success in spreading Krishna consciousness, and for our survival in maintaining our own Krishna consciousness. And when we understand these things carefully, then we will not take the association of devotees for granted, nor will we allow insignificant differences, whether they're egoistic differences or idiocentric differences, they will not stand between us. We must understand the absolute necessity to be united. United States, United Kingdom, Soviet Union, all these great powerful countries. Their power was their unity. And Srila Prabhupada, he named this society the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. International means unity. A union of international people in international places who are all serving the same cause, Krishna consciousness. Does that answer your question? Is there any other questions?
Most of the people now here in this room are going to pass out next year.
Pass out? Hare Krishna. You will all pass out.
Next year. Two things are there. One is a lot of career options. Because the job market is not so good in India.
Hmm.
Some of them may have to go abroad and study in the USA.
Hmm.
Devamrit Maharaj was here.
Hmm.
Discussion about this.
Hmm.
What are the options?
Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy is unity in diversity. So although Devamrita Maharaj and I are perfectly unified in our love and our friendship and our respect, we have diversities also. I think what Devamrita Maharaj is trying to tell you is not simply that you should not go abroad, but the dangers of going abroad. Actually, we have many devotees from Radha Gopinath's congregation who are abroad and who are really leading, preaching in various parts of the world. Dhananjaya Prabhu was in Portland, Oregon. He's making more devotees than anyone else in Oregon. He's doing a good job. He's a good devotee. What's his name? Shyam Sundar and Radhika Sundari, Gaur Govinda's sister. They were such a major influence in spreading Krishna consciousness in America. In fact, right now, they're holding the most important position of in charge of the fundraising department for New Vrindavan, because he was laid off for his job for temporarily, so he went there. So he's doing tremendous service. President of New Vrindavan says they're the most valuable people in the whole community. Shyam Gopal Prabhu in Columbus, in Cincinnati, Malati Mataji says he's the most important devotee they have. Rasanath Prabhu, He's such a valuable asset to the preaching in New York. He's one of your colleagues, yes? Vasanath Prabhu. He's maintaining very high standards of devotional service, as high as anybody at Radha Gopinath Temple. So yes, going to the West is extremely dangerous, and the temptations there, generally, they overcome and overwhelm everyone. Because there's so much promise of happy, comfortable life living in a materialistic way. In India, no matter how comfortable and nice everything is, still it's India. Still, there's just basic austerities that everybody has to deal with. Even if you're living in Malabar Hill, you walk 10 minutes and someone's passing stool on the side of the street. Still, it's like that. What can you do? I remember when my mother and father came to India. They're from America. They're not accustomed to the things you see in India. So Krishna Chandra's father arranged in Jaipur that they stay at the Sheraton Hilton Hotel. Sheraton Hotel is an international American hotel which has very high standards. So I visited them. I was sitting in the room with them, and there was a power shortage. All the lights went out. Now, this is an American hotel, one of the most expensive and highly publicized as a great hotel in all of America. Even Americans have to pay a lot in America to stay in Sheraton Hotel. So they were thinking, here I am. This is so nice of Mr. Muffetlal. He has put us in this 5-star American hotel. And for 3 hours, there was no lights. And they were looking at me, and I said, this is India. Indians are just part of their life. But for an American, it's an impossible situation. It never happens. When Prabhupada was in New York, there was a famous power failure for about 8 hours in New York City, in that whole area. All the electricity went out. The entire section of the United States was in total chaos. Billions of dollars lost. Crime, people were just going mad, just robbing each other and stealing each other, and they couldn't watch television. People were jumping out of buildings. It was incredible. It was biggest news of the year, the power shortage in New York. It's still, everybody remembers it. It was back in the 60s. But India, how many power shortages? Power shortage comes in Bombay, everyone just, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. They just go on with their life. And so it is a fact that America is very, very highly elevated in their sophisticated scientific methodology of comfortable material enjoyment. And there's a whole facade. And actually I have seen that there are several of our devotees who have gone there who have fallen right into the trap. They're still devotees, but not at all the same as what they used to be. They never want to come back to India. Drive on those roads in India after you're going on the interstate highways of America. However nice the highways are between Bombay and Pune and all of these things, when you drive the interstates in America, it's unbelievable. You can drive from any point of the country to any other point of the country without ever having to stop, except you need refueling once you get on the interstate system. Big, wide, smooth highways. Every part of America you can go 3,000 miles without ever stopping. And when you want fuel, you just go on this. There's special fueling systems where there's restaurants and there's different types of stores and there's entertainment and everything. And the bathrooms in America are they Krishna? On the highways, when you're driving, they have whole areas with multi-million-dollar restroom facilities everywhere. I don't want to put you in Maya by speaking these things, but it's a fact. So many devotees go there, and then when they go there, they just become hypnotized. They just can't tolerate even the thought of coming back to the austere, primitive culture of India. Even Bombay primitive culture, compared to the West. And they become infatuated. So there is a great danger. But we find that those devotees who stay in good association, who maintain good sadhana, who understand the dangers, they're very strong, and they're having a tremendous influence on changing the hearts of the Americans and the Indians in America also. And actually, devotees in Europe, and not only America, also Europe, so many people of our congregation are in these various places. And most of them are doing exceptionally well and having a very, very positive influence and making a great contribution to Prabhupada's society. In fact, many of them are having a much greater influence there than they would here. Because here there's so many strong, wonderful devotees. But there, they're practically the only ones. So if you're going to the West because you're starry-eyed about the material, luxurious type of situation there, then you are in a despicable state of illusion. Because the fact is, we were discussing last night, although superficially America has all these very expert ways of creating a gross physical environment where there's much comfort and enjoyment, internally, there's so much frustration. There's so much hopelessness. We discussed some of those things yesterday. In the richest suburbs, little kids are going into their schools and shooting their classmates with high-powered ammunition. And therefore, the people in the suburbs are afraid of, like anything, what's going to happen to their children in school. It's not like that in India, is it? The crime in the cities, unbelievable. Even when I was young, and now it's worse today, even when I was young, there are certain neighborhoods which comprise over half of any major city in America. That are so dangerous. So dangerous. You just never go there. There is so much animosity, anger, and hatred between the blacks and the whites, between the Mexicans and the whites and the blacks, and all these different areas. I remember places like Detroit, Chicago, Cleveland. 75% of the city are black people, and there are neighborhoods which cover most of the city that if a white man goes in the neighborhood, he'll either be killed, raped, or beaten, or robbed. You just don't. As soon as they see a different color person, you're finished. That's the way I grew up in America. And in the cities, there's so many vicious street gangs that are constantly killing each other. Why? Because of frustration. Believe me, if you just open up the thin veneer of Americans' appearance, and this is all the European countries too, you will see so much hatred, so much anxiety, so much anguish behind it all. India is a safer place. But ultimately, the safest place is where we have nice association and where we're maintaining good sadhana. So personally, if you have a strong determination to maintain good association, to maintain good sadhana, then you can do great things in America. But the main, most important factor is, what's your priority in life? Is it to be Krishna conscious? Even though we have to perform our occupation somewhere else, is it to become Krishna conscious? We have one devotee in America, Radha Giridhari. I don't know how many of you have been around for some years, but at one time our temple was just very small. It's expanded. It's expanded in so many ways. You have seen all the stonework in front of the temple. You've seen that hall downstairs where Tinkerbell High School used to be. Huh? Do you know how that all came about? Because of the donations of Radha Giridhari. He's a devotee who used to be a brahmachari at Radha Gopinath Temple. He got married, and for his business, he went to America. And he has given millions of dollars to our temple to renovate it. And he's still perfectly Krishna conscious. Just like what some of these IIT, they graduate here, go to America, and then send money to develop IIT. He's doing the same thing for Radha Gopinath Temple. He's doing a tremendous service because he's putting Krishna first. So if you make Krishna your priority, if you make Prabhupada's mission priority, then even if you go to America, you can actually do great things. But if you're not extremely careful, and extremely strong spiritually in your sadhana and in your association, then you can be a major casualty. So I don't say you shouldn't go, because in many ways the rest of the world temples are dying and begging for people for you to come and settle down near their temples and generate the influence of the training you have gotten here to uplift them and sustain them. But if you go for sense gratification, then Hare Krishna. It's too much. Does that answer your question? So I will not discourage anyone from going abroad if they have the proper motives and the proper determination. But the more bad things you hear about these places, the better. That's why we're very happy when Devamrita Swami comes. Very eloquent at describing. And this description will make us more sober. If we're not very sober, we usually become infatuated. We usually become infatuated. Like Mahaprabhu, he knows what America is. He knows what America is. He lived 60 years of his life in India safely. He's living kind of simple, making some money, doing his family things, doing his devotional service. He went to America and decided to do just some very simple little business. And some crazy person just came and beat him on the head, right? Tell him what happened. Huh?
Beat in my head.
You were beat up like that in India in all your 60 years here? God bless America. So you should understand. Here is a person. Eyewitness.
They told me that you are the only person who...
So he was living in India for so many years, he was never beaten. Went to America, 7 fractures, unconscious, laying on the street in a pool of blood. And what was he doing? He was just sitting there. Somebody just came up. So Mahaprabhu was not very attached to America.
I went to the concert where the devotees were distributing Bhagavad Gita. I was with them and I was going to Philadelphia because they wanted me to give lecture in the morning. I wrote a class.
So yes, it is the content within the book of materialistic Western society is full of violence, bloodshed, suicide, anxiety. It's not a nice place. I find by far, despite its poverty and disorganization and everything else, Indian people are much more peaceful and self-satisfied. Huh? But if you can be like Radha Giridhari or Rasanath Prabhu or Shyam Sundar Prabhu and go there out of a certain necessity and maintain high standards of Krishna consciousness, maintain high degree of communication with the devotees back in India, then you can do actual wonderful things there. It's like a firefighter going into a fire. If you're a firefighter going into fire and you don't know the dangers of fire, if you're complacent or inattentive, you will be burned. You're that 1%? Just that? Most people just dance into the fire and get burnt. If you're going to be a fire, if you're going to go into the fire, you have to have your helmet and your fire put close, and you have to be very, very careful, otherwise you will be burned. But then again, Srila Prabhupada, Bharata Bhumi Tehvaila Manusya Janmachar, he wanted devotees from India to go all over the world to spread Krishna consciousness. But it should be for spreading Krishna consciousness. Even if you go for some financial reasons or for some job reasons, your real purpose beyond that should be, I have to do it for this purpose, but let me spread Krishna consciousness while I'm there. Let me help the devotees spread Krishna consciousness. Then you will have Prabhupada's protection and his blessings. And once every year in America, we have a reunion of Radha Gopinath's devotees. Last year you were there, there was about 30 people, all Indian people from Radha Gopinath temple who came to New Vrindavan. We had a parikrama of New Vrindavan. It was so nice. And all the devotees were saying it's just absolutely identical to the parikramas and the yatras in India. Same spirit, same enthusiasm. We were just going from place to place discussing histories and Prabhupada's leelas and Krishna's leelas. Oh, he's also filed a court case against the city of New York for letting him get beat on the head. As a lawyer, he sees the positive opportunities through the legal system. Any other question? Yes, Phil. How many parts is this question? Your question is how to avoid pride? We must hear Harikatha from authorized sources every day. Otherwise, we will without doubt, we will forget what is the dangers and miseries of material existence. It's very important that we hear every day. Whenever we read Srila Prabhupada's books or hear from Srila Prabhupada's devotees, we are reminded of the miseries and the dangers of material life.